Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 19th of Tevet. Today we're going to spend most of our time on a short series of three tshuvot that Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote to Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, who was a Rav and Posek in Memphis, and with whom Rav Moshe Feinstein had a close relationship throughout the time from when Rav Moshe met him as a student, and then he went to Memphis, and they had a continuing correspondence. Ephraim Greenblatt was a tremendous Talmid Chacham in his own right. And interestingly, there are three letters dated the 19th of Tevet of Tafshin Lamed Bet of 1972 that Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote to Rav Ephraim Greenblatt, but they appear as three different tshuvot in Igorot Moshe. I happened to find them because I was searching for dates, and then once I saw a bunch for Rav Moshe on the same 19th of Tevet, I noticed the dates. So it's kind of interesting that he chose to write, I don't know if he wrote it as three letters, I don't know if he put it in three envelopes or one envelope, I don't know if it's three different pieces of paper in the thing, but they seem to have gotten filed separately in Rav Moshe's writings, and so the first two are published in the same volume of Igros Moshe. Nope, all three are published in the same volume of Igros Moshe. One is as number 77 in the third Orach Chaim volume. One is 31 in third Orach Chaim volume. One is 41 in third Orach Chaim volume. So if Moshe spreads them out, I have no idea of why. But in any case, they're all from the same date, so we will study them as if they were one tshuva, and they will become our response of the day. And if we have a little extra time in the end, there's another 19th of Tevet tshuvot in Igrot Moshe that we can talk about as well. The first question, I'm not sure why I put them in this order, because they appear, I should really do it in the order that they appear in Igrot Moshe, but I'll do it in the order that I have it in front of me. No, I'll do it in the order of how they appear in Igrot Moshe. So the first one, number 31, is a question that Rabbi Greenblatt asked him about chocolate-covered raisins. So what bracha do you make on chocolate-covered raisins? Because in general, you have two items together as a food, you'd want to make a bracha on the ikar, on the main food. So let's say if you have some kind of a food that you eat on very thin crackers, so very often the bracha will be, you'll decide the bracha will be on the food on the crackers, and the crackers are considered tefelim, they're considered subordinate to the food that goes on them, and they're sort of just there to help us be able to hold the food, or eat the food, and therefore you'd make a bracha only on the food itself. So that's a simple halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. He points out the Magen Avraham there says that you make the crackers, the whole point of the crackers, the whole point of the little pieces of bread is that your hands don't get dirty, right? So if it's some food that would make your hands dirty, it's like a dip and you want to just be able to look up. So in those cases, he's saying you're only eating the cracker for the sake of not getting the hands dirty. So then you make the brach on the item that is a more important item. This can be a complicated halakha question. So, for example, dip. If I pick up a piece of pita, let's say you have pitas into triangles, I have triangles of pita and I have hummus there, and I take the pita and I dip it into the hummus, what am I really eating? If I'm really interested in eating hummus, then theoretically you'd make the bracha only of a shahakal on the hummus, and not, assuming it's not hummus that has pieces of actual chickpeas in it, but you have, I'll make the bracha on the hummus and not on the pita at all. That would be true. There are cases where, you know, if you have a very sharp herring or whatever, you don't make a bracha on the cracker if you're really not interested in the cracker. In this case, the Rav Moshe is talking about, which would be relevant to what I was sort of hinting at a second ago, in the case of chocolate-covered raisins, he says, so there he's not sure, because you might be interested in both. You like the chocolate. You're not eating the chocolate just so you can get to the raisin, but on the other hand, you like the raisins as well. So you might like them both. And he points out the Machzor HaShekel says that in other cases, you would eat, you'd make a bracha on both of them. And the Mishnah Berurah thinks that you might try to find an ikar, the central item. So in the case where you're eating foods and you have two foods that are being eaten together, that becomes always the question. Am I eating one food just to help eat the other? Or are they two separate foods both of which I like? And if I like both of them, the Machzor HaShekel seems to think that I have to make a bracha on both of them. In the case of chocolate-covered raisins, clearly the raisins are the issue. It's not just a way to eat chocolate, because if it was just a way to eat chocolate, you'd eat just chocolate. So you like the raisin part of it, but you also like the chocolate part of it. So therefore, Moshe Feinstein thinks you have to make a bracha on both of them. That would be a Bori Pia 8 on the raisins, and then a Shehakel on the chocolate. So the problem, though, is, in general, when you want to make a Bari Priya Eitz and then a Shehakol, we're supposed to make the Bari Priya Eitz first, because otherwise Shehakol covers the Bari Priya Eitz, even though it's not supposed to. It's a broader bracha that can incorporate it. So you might say, he says, okay, so make the Bari Priya Eitz and then the Shehakol. The problem with that is, the Rav Moshe, since the raisins are covered, you can't get to the raisins until you've eaten some chocolate. So you'll have to make a shahakal on the chocolate because you're going to eat, and that will that might make us think we're necessarily going to have already made a bracha that covers the raisins. So therefore, if he has uncovered raisins, like let's say you just got a box of raisins too, that would be great. Or if you could find some other fruit, make a bracha on those fruit, on that fruit or the raisins first, that would give you the eight, and therefore, and afterwards you can make a shahakal. So that's very much the finest thing. You have to approach chocolate-covered raisins. In this same response, very briefly, he deals with the question of a tape recorder. Let's suppose, for example, you are listening, this would apply to an audio file as well, to an MP3, you're listening to this and I'm recording it. Let's suppose I was going to make a bracha and I made it with the Shem Hashem, or in some way I invoked the Shem Hashem and I used the actual Shem, the actual name of Hashem. So would we say that you can never erase that tape or that file or that this because it's got the Shem Hashem on it? This comes up, by the way, a lot in terms of also in printing. It came up in terms of computer screens, right? Are you allowed to erase a computer screen or change the screen if it has the name of Hashem on it? So he has it in 1972 in terms of a tape recorder. You have Shemot. So he says he thinks that there's no particular specific iser on erasing it because there aren't any letters there. And he thinks of the whole idea of Mechikat Hashem is a problem of erasing letters. But nonetheless, he says it could be that you shouldn't do it because it'll look to people like you're erasing Shem Hashem. But he says, but if you do it by a grumba way, meaning it just happens, you don't erase it yourself, but something happens that causes it to erase, maybe there he thinks there's no prohibition. So that is the first part of, that's what I really think it is, the first part of his discussion of halachic issues with Ephraim Greenblatt for the 19th of Tevet. That was number 31 in Or HaChaim Gimel. Number 41 in Or HaChaim Gimel is about, let's say you have a Sefer Torah, and there are some places in the Torah where we write the words in the Torah very different, completely differently than the way the word is read. Meaning, usually what's called a ketiv or a kri, it's written one way, but another way is when you write it with or without an extra letter. And then you'll read it a different way. But sometimes there are a few words in the Torah where it's written one way and we read it a completely different way. And so the question that was raised was, do you have to look inside the Torah at the time that you're doing it? Normally, you're not allowed to read the Torah ba'al peh. So let's suppose I've prepared a parsha and I'm relaying it. And I know it very, very well. So, for example, let's suppose I'm turning the column to the next column, but I don't want to pause, and the column isn't turned yet, but I know the words that are coming. So I say that I'm not allowed to do that. That's reading it by al-peh, that's reading it by heart. And we, in Kriyat HaTorah, in Shul, are not allowed to read the Torah by heart. So, on our 19th of Tevet Tshuva, he addresses Rav Ephraim Greenblatt. One of the examples is when the Torah writes in the Tochacha, when the Torah once threatens us or warns us that if we sin enough, various terrible things will happen to us. Among the terrible things that happen to us is that people will get married, men will marry women, and other people will eventually bed those women, will have relations with those women. The word written in the Torah is a word that called Yishgalena, which was changed, however it was changed. It was turned into a Kri Oktiv, however that happened. But the Kri is Yishgavena, which means we'll lie with her, and I think is understood to be a more delicate term than Yishgalena. The question is, let's say I'm reading the Torah and I get up to that word, is there any reason I have to look inside at the word? Because after all, when I look inside the word I'm looking at says Yishgalena, which is not the word I'm reading. So maybe I don't even have to look inside. So Rav Moshe points out that in an earlier volume of Igrot Moshe, he had suggested that let's suppose a piece of wax or something else that covers a word falls onto the word Yishgalena. So he's going to say it's very similar. It's not exactly the same. The word is written Yishgalena. I'm looking inside, but there's wax covering it. So he held that he thinks that you'd have to. So in other words in the Torah, if this happened, the word is covered and you couldn't see it. So you'd have to close up the Sefer Torah and take out another one, right? So Rav Moshe Feinstein had said he thinks that's true of Yishgavena as well, because once the word is covered, it means the Torah isn't usable. And even if I'm not going to read the word as it's written, nonetheless, it makes the Torah unusable. And he had said the reason is you're not allowed to read the Torah ba'al peh. And once there's wax covering the Torah, you're reading it ba'al peh. Then it's necessarily about, but it's necessarily by heart because the word is covered. You couldn't possibly read it inside. So in that earlier response of Rav Moshe Feinstein, he said, so therefore he thinks that the fact that you're not going to read the word the way it's written doesn't matter. Once the word is covered by this wax that makes it illegible or unreadable, so therefore you have to change the Sefer Torah and find a Sefer Torah that doesn't have that problem with it. A problem with that idea, he points out, is that the Magen Avraham in Kuf Mem Aleph, in 141.9, when he's talking about a word that is a kri. So, until now, it would seem like Rav Moshe Feinstein was saying that reading a word, in, even if it's being read differently than it's written, you have to really still be able to look at it and see it inside, and wax covering it is a problem. Therefore, theoretically, reading it by heart also would seem to be a problem. However, this Magen Avraham that I mentioned says that a tevash he kri uchtiv, you read it differently than it's written, even if you read it by heart, it's okay. So it's an explicit Magen Avraham that seems to say that it is okay for the word like that. Since you're not going to read it the way it's written anyway, you're allowed to read it be'al peh. Shouldn't that mean that if wax fell on it, you could also read it because it's not a problem, and you shouldn't have to get another Sefer Torah, and that would contradict what Rav Moshe Feinstein had said. So I didn't look up the other tshuva because I've got a bunch of tshuvot that I want to get to, all for the 19th of Tevet, but it seems like Rav Moshe didn't remember that Magen Avraham when he wrote the earlier tshuva, which would be an interesting insight into Rav Moshe Feinstein and how he worked and what he knew and what he was aware of, what was before him, but another time. But it seems like the Magen Avraham would hold that way, right? That's the seeming implication of the Magen Avraham's idea. So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes of Ma'achar Shelo Amar Zeh Beferush, Demechadesh Yechol Likrot Ota Teva Kihakri Gam Keshu Mechuseh Efshar Lomar. He doesn't say it explicitly that when the wax is covering it, you can read it al peh. The Rav Moshe Feinstein says, so therefore, maybe I could suggest. He says, I think he could suggest that it's not true. That it's only when it's the word is uncovered, then the Magen Avraham says you can read it by heart because you're not reading the real word, but. But if it was actually physically covered by something, so that would be a problem, even if I'm not going to read the word that it's written. And therefore, he says, so you can't know. It's not clear which one of those is truth. If we can prove the word either way, so therefore he thinks you should act halakhically the way he said, which I think is that when it comes to wax falling on it, you'd have to put it back because you don't have to have it covered. And then, but that if you ended up reading it be'al peh, if you ended up reading it just by heart, that itself wouldn't be a problem. So I think that's the way Rav Moshe has it. You're not allowed to have anything covering it because that makes it physically unable to be read, and that you're not allowed to have. But the fact is, since you're not going to read it the way it's written anyway, if you ended up reading that word be'al peh by heart, that would not be a problem. That is the second response of Rav Moshe's from the 19th of Tevet of 1972 to Ephraim Greenblatt. Okay, and now the third of these brief tshuvot. I think we're going to get to the 1963 tshuvot as well. It's from 77, response number 77, in the third time Rav Moshe Feinstein addressed Or HaChaim issues in Igrot Moshe. And this is about somebody from outside of Israel who's in Israel for Yom Tov, and is observing 2 days of Yom Tov, very relevant to the tshuva. It's the response that Rav Moshe takes for granted, as if it's clear and not questionable. That, and I think he does this consistently throughout Igrot Moshe, that a Jew from outside of Israel who is in Israel for a Yom Tov has to keep 2 days, and has to keep 2 days like he was in America. It's like a full Yom Tov of Yom Tov Sheni Shagolia for that person. The question is, what happens if there is a funeral, including eulogies, for a Torah scholar? Can this person from outside of Israel go to the funeral and hear the eulogies? Because, after all, eulogies contradict the idea of Yom Tov. On a holiday, we don't generally have funerals or eulogies, and therefore that's the question. This is the 19th of Tevet again to Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt. And he says, so there's a complicated halacha in the Gemara about what to do with people who pass away right around Yom Tov. And some of these we do apply today, and some of them we really don't apply today. But the fact is, the halacha in the Gemara is, and the halacha on the books is, that somebody who passes away on the first day of Yom Tov, if there's an urge or need to bury them, and remember that until there was refrigeration, the urge to bury quickly was even more pressing than it is today. Today it's a common Jewish practice. We certainly do our best to try to make burials happen as quickly as possible. We sometimes wait for relatives to be able to arrive because we think it's honorable. It's an honor of the person who passed away to have more people at the funeral. But we can. But if a funeral gets delayed for a day or even two, we don't have to worry that decomposing is going to happen, or that you know there's going to be a problem with smell, or that there's going to be a problem with disease because of refrigeration. But in olden times, by the times gone by, that was certainly an issue. So the Gemara talks about the fact that on the first day of Yom Tov, you're allowed to have somebody be buried by non-Jews. So I really don't think we do this anymore. But it also says that on the second day of Yom Tov, Jews can bury the person. So I once saw this a few years ago. There was some terrible tragedy in some Hasidic community in Brooklyn in Borough Park. I forget which one, but somebody, it was a terrible tragedy. It was like a granddaughter of some Rebbe passed, of one of the Rebbe's passed away, and they had a huge funeral on the second day. So it was clear that everybody involved in the funeral was just burying the person. And that's absolutely the halacha. It just looks strange because nobody does it anymore because I think refrigeration and the desire for honor for the person who passed away and gathering relatives and whatever means that we can wait a day and it's not a tragedy. It's not a, I mean, it's always a tragedy when people pass away, but it's not an added problem to do so. In any case, that's the halachic background to what we're going to talk about. So he says, when Chazal said in the Gemara, and this is the halacha, that Yom Tov Sheni Shel Goliot, the second day of Yom Tov outside of Israel, Kichol Shavyuhu Rabbanan, they made it like a non-holiday when it comes to the question of burying somebody who's passed away. Rav Moshe Feinstein says he thinks that's only about burial. That's what the Gemara says, Linyan Kvurat HaMeit. But he doesn't think they made it. They took it away, they abrogated it, they made it like not a Yom Tov, in terms of hesped, in terms of eulogies, which would mean halakhically that if a community decided for whatever reason, or a family decided for whatever reason, they needed to bury a relative who had passed away on the second day of Yom Tov, that's perfectly acceptable. But Moshe Feinstein is suggesting, but they wouldn't really be able to have eulogies. Now, this person who's in Israel has the challenge because the people in Israel have no need not to have the eulogies because for them it's not at all a Yom Tov because they keep one day of Yom Tov. The residents of Israel keep one day of Yom Tov. So therefore, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, even if it's a Talmid Chacham, right, the Torah scholar, we owe honor to a Torah scholar. And therefore, you might have thought that we should go to the eulogies of the Torah scholar. If they're burying him on the second day of Yom Tov in outside of Israel, you shouldn't have hespedim. You shouldn't have eulogies because in that sense, he thinks, there was no abrogating of Yom Tov Sheni. And that would mean, Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks, that the Ben Chutz La'aretz, the person from outside of Israel, who's in Israel for Yom Tov, who has a din of Yom Tov, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who's fully observing second day Yom Tov, he thinks he can't go hear the eulogies. Now that's means that Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks it's not only we can't make eulogies in Yom Tov because having the public eulogy is a violation of Yom Tov, he thinks that hearing a eulogy is a violation of that person's Yom Tov. That's an assumption, I'm not questioning it, I'm just pointing it out. Right? I could easily have imagined the reason why you're not allowed to have eulogies in Yom Tov is because it's wrong for in a public forum for us to so clearly violate the spirit of Yom Tov by eulogizing somebody who had passed away. But in the Israel case, the people setting up the funeral, the people giving the eulogies have no Yom Tov issue. They have no holiday issue facing them at all. I could have imagined, therefore, that you would say that attending at a eulogy is not a violation of Yom Tov if the eulogy itself is not a Yom Tov. I think that Rav Moshe Feinstein completely disagrees with that. It's very clear to him that part of observing a day of Yom Tov, including a second day of Yom Tov, is maintaining a certain sense of joy and happiness and celebration of the day. And that is contradicted by hearing a eulogy for somebody who passed away, and therefore he thinks that the person cannot go. But this same person from outside of Israel who can't go to the eulogies, if he or she wants to be part of the funeral, part of the halvayatemet of accompanying the person, the deceased, to the gravesite, so for sure if the gravesite, the cemetery is within the tchum, is within the area of the city that this person is allowed to walk, right? We have this idea on Yom Tov, Shabbos and Yom Tov, that you're only allowed to walk within 2,000 amot of the outside of the city. So sometimes you have plenty of cemeteries in Israel for sure, in the new city of Yerushalayim, but in other places in Israel too, where the cemetery is within the tchum of the city. So he could do that. Because the truth is, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that if you ever were going to bury somebody on the first day of Yom Tov, and you're going to have non-Jews do the burial, the halacha is you can do that, and you have non-Jews do the burial, you can have Jews who are allowed to walk along, Rav Moshe Feinstein says. I think he means because walking along with a person who's passed away isn't violating Yom Tov anyway, so he thinks you can walk along. Now that's a little surprising, only because he wasn't willing to let this person hear a eulogy because that was too much of a violation of the spirit of Yom Tov. But when it comes to the first day of Yom Tov, where Chazal apparently assumed that actually burying the person with Jewish labor, with Jews doing the work, is too much of a violation of the spirit of Yom Tov. Rosh Feinstein seems to think that walking along is not a violation of the spirit of Yom Tov, at least in terms of what Chazal were worried about. He thinks that that's also allowed. I think that's a chiddush, an interesting new idea. And he adds, the Gemara talks about the question of how many people need to be at a funeral. So when it comes to an Adam Gadol, a person who had a great impact on the Jewish community, a great Torah impact on the community, and they're really a leader of the Torah world of the Jewish community. So there the Gemara says there's no shear, meaning there's no amount of people where you can say, you know what, there's enough people going, I'm not obligated to join in and to go. So for example, let's say when Rav Vadi Yosef passed away and whatever numbers of hundreds of thousands of people attended the funeral, part of the reason for that is that people would say to themselves, and Adam Gadol has passed away, a great man has passed away, and it's not my ability not to go to the funeral. If that were true about this person, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, then even this outside of Israel Jew who's in Israel for Yom Tov, he thinks could actually go outside the Tchum as well. Because when we say in the Gemara that Chazal made Yom Tov Sheni, the second day of Yom Tov, Kechol, like a non-holiday in terms of burying those who had passed away, Rav Moshe Feinstein says it means like Chol. So for this Jew, even though he's celebrating second Yom Tov, but he's helping bury somebody. So you could say, well, that's only if he's necessary to the burial. So the answer is with an Adam Gadol, with a great person, the halacha is everybody's considered necessary to the funeral. There is no shear. There is no amount by which we say, at which point we'll say, you know, that's enough. And this will come up in other contexts as well, meaning, let's suppose there are people who have various other important things, activities they're doing, some of whom are learning Torah, some of them this, some of that, and a funeral arises. So the halacha is, if a funeral arises, you need to go. But you only need to go to the extent that they are not covered. So the definition of covered differs for different kinds of people. For an Adam Gadol, there is no idea of covered. Therefore, everybody has to go. So therefore, Moshe Feinstein thinks that this outside of Israel Jew can apply to himself as well, this halacha of, that in terms of burying those who have passed away, they turn the second day Yom Tov into Chol, that'll apply to him as well. Now, what about a regular Talmud Chacham? Not an Adam Gadol, but a Talmud Chacham was learned and knows and reviewed and teaches. So there the standard in the Gemara is Shishim Ribo, which would be 600,000 people, which rarely happens today. As I said before, Vadi Yosef's funeral was remarkable in the number of people who went, and it was over 600,000, but only just. When Rav Moshe Feinstein, clearly another Adam Gadol, passed away, it was not, I believe, that to that extent. There was a lot of people, but not to that extent. So you theoretically say that would be true for any Talmud Chacham, that any Torah scholar passes away, this outside of Israel Jew could join the funeral fully, even to leave and go outside of the Tchum, to go outside of the city farther than ordinarily he would be allowed to, because we say that they made the second day of Yom Tov like Chol. So Moshe Feinstein says it's not quite true, because if you look at how people handle it, even though it's true that 600,000 is the number, you don't find that. You see that people have all sorts of reasons that they allow themselves not to go and join in such a funeral. Right? You know, if Torah Scholar X passes away, and I didn't have anything to do with Torah Scholar X, I didn't know him, I knew of him, right? I knew some of his writings, maybe. I wasn't a student, I wasn't a family member, I wasn't a friend, I wasn't this, I wasn't that, and I know that there'll be 5,000 people at the funeral. I'm fairly certain that many, many people would say to themselves, Rav Moshe Feinstein saying this, would say to themselves, I don't need to go. So for all that the halacha on the books is, that up until 600,000 is not, you haven't reached the minimum yet, really you should be trying to go. But since people find all sorts of reasons to say, I have other activities that mean I am not required to go, he thinks this person, I don't know why I think it's a young man, I guess he likes it's a person there for the year. Whoever this person is who's in Israel for the Yom Tov, said the fact that it's Yom Tov for him or her, Moshe Feinstein thinks that's probably enough to say that he shouldn't just ignore it. For all that, the halacha is he can ignore it because Chazal made it like not a Yom Tov in terms of burying those who passed away. For those burials where on a non-Yom Tov day you'd find plenty of reason not to go, he thinks the fact that it is for this person a Yom Tov day should be enough as well. But if he's going to be one of the pallbearers, if he's going to be one of the people bearing the Aron, then he thinks it's allowed. Even if it were true that there are plenty of people to bury the Aron, to bear the coffin without him, and all those other people are residents of Israel, and therefore they're not violating Yom Tov at all, he thinks that nonetheless, because Chazal said that Yom Tov Sheni is completely mutar, right, and can be done by Jews, and they made it like a regular day, not a holiday. That means that in some cases, when we say Chazal said you can do something that you ordinarily can't do, it's called a dechiyah. They push aside the usual prohibition. But here, they don't push it aside. They were matirit. So therefore, Moshe Feinstein thinks that if they were matirit, so then those things that this person would ordinarily do, like bear the coffin, even though it's not an absolute obligation, even though there's somebody else to do it, he thinks he's allowed to do it. So that's a interesting distinction between burying the person who passed away and just being part of the funeral and being part of the Havayat Hameh. He thinks that burying the coffin, burying the bier, burying the body is enough of, I don't know if it's a privilege or enough of a partaking of the funeral in a way that you wouldn't have been until now, that even for this person who's observing Second Day Yom Tov in Israel would have the right to ignore it, to fall in with the original halacha in the Gemara, that it's like chol for him as well, despite the fact there are plenty of other people who could have handled this. So that's his ideas. Now he closes with, I think, what I think is a very interesting statement that comes up a bunch of times in these kinds of tshuvot. He says, V'raya mi gemara mi divrei rabotenu le'yodu'li. I can't prove it. I don't have a Gemara, I don't have a Chazal, I don't have a Rishon, I don't have an Achron who says it in a way that makes sense to me, but kein mistabra l'chora, but that's what it seems to me. I've learned these issues, I know our feelings about burial, about Yom Tov Sheni, about bearing a coffin, about being part of a Levaya, and all from what all I know, this is what seems right to me. Rav Moshe Feinstein has that confidence. I mean, by this time, this is 1972, he's already in his late 70s, and he's been a posek, an important posek for decades, but it's a confidence to watch and to note, and I don't think that all of us would necessarily have that confidence, and probably all of us shouldn't have that confidence, but it's an aspect of Rav Moshe Feinstein's work that I find interesting every time I come across it. So I have a couple of minutes left. There are two more brief tshuvot, brief responses from the 19th of Tevet that I found in Rav Moshe's writings. This is from, it's actually an earlier volume of Or HaChaim, is the one that I'm about to do. It's from Or HaChaim Bet. And it's from earlier, it's from 1963. It seems that in Scranton, Pennsylvania, somebody had the idea, there were four shuls, and somebody had the idea to unify them. And by unifying them, the theory was it would be a bigger shul and you'd get more benefit. There is a halachic principle of Birovam Hadrat Melech. And when you have a larger group of Jews together worshiping Hashem, that's more of an honor to Hashem in some way than if just small pockets of people. And that is part of the push to have bigger shuls. There are pushes the other way as well. But that would be part of the push to have bigger shuls. So the idea in this grant was to unify four shuls and put them into one. Rav Moshe Feinstein objects, and I don't know if his diagnosis is correct, but his assumption, his understanding is, and I don't have any idea, he may have been right, was that really this was a push to try to over time turn the one big shul into a conservative reform synagogue. And he says that the idea is going to come up, and again, this may be facts on the ground. It may be that he's guessing. This may be a fact of the situation, that as soon as they combine the shuls, they'll say, the new shul is so big, we need a microphone. So that'll be a way to push it in. And they'll say, you know, when the rabbi speaks, he's going to have to use a microphone, which Rav Moshe Feinstein says is chilul Shabbat, is a violation of Shabbat. Topic of its own, because I think, for example, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was not quite as clear, but in the context of America in the early 60s, when the battles with Reform and Conservative were still very tense, and the survival, long-term survival of Orthodoxy was not very clear, Rav Moshe Feinstein is sure that that's something that we have to worry about, and if we have to make sure to stop it from happening. Then he says, the truth is, you leave that aside. We don't close down shuls that are well-functioning, and we think it's prohibited to do so. We, in the context of a responsive day, have seen other response about selling a shul, and I try not to do too many of the same topic, even though they seem to come up a lot. So I guess it's either catching my eye a lot or it's actually out there a lot. But Rav Moshe Feinstein is also going to deal with that question of, he says, we don't close down shul. He quotes the Magen Avraham, he quotes a Rivash that we've actually seen on other occasions as well, that if somebody stops other people from building a new shul, let alone closing down a shul, if somebody stops somebody from building a new shul, even if there's already a shul that where people can pray, and in the old, and by leaving the one shul, you'll have Berovah Madrid Melk, you'll have more people there, it's prohibited, and it's like you're stopping the people from doing a mitzvah, which makes you somebody worth shunning. So the Rivash takes the position. There are lots of factors. Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to recognize a lot of facts as well. But the position of the Rivash was, let shuls bloom. Right? Let shuls just build up. Now, happens to be there are other complications get in the way, because what if the building of the new shul is going to ruin the old shul? So that's not a topic that comes up in that Rivash. In the Rivash's case, it seems to be that building the new shul, the only problem was the old shul wouldn't be as big as it used to be, and people liked having a big old shul. So Moshe Feinstein says it's clear that the reason why you should let new shuls build is because the new shul might be more of convenient to people who live a distance from the old shul. So they don't want to go walk all the way to the old shul, but have this new shul, and it's closer. They'll daven with a minyan, and that's better. And they hear a kaddish, they hear kedusha, and that's better. I would just point out that nowadays, you sometimes have people who build new shuls a block, literally a block from the old shul. And there, it's hard to imagine that's true, and that's a relevant factor. So one can, in these kinds of cases, fully agree with the Rivash, fully agree with the Rivash of Feinstein, and yet also say that it's not always true that building a new shul is a good idea. But in general, the idea is that you spread more shuls, the better it is. And as the Magen Avraham also quoted Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrachi, who disagreed, and he thought that it's better to keep one shul together as long as it can hold all of them, and they're not allowed to split up, because he held that Rovam Hadras Melech, having a lot of people serve Hashem together, was better. Rav Moshe is sure that the Rav Eliyahu Mizrachi only meant once we already have a big shul, and now you're going to try to split it up into two shuls, that you're not allowed to do, because you're not allowed to, you're not supposed to prefer one value of spreading more kedusha in the world, of having more opportunities and more locations so people can have the convenience of a close-by shul. That shouldn't outweigh the existing value of Rav Hadras Melech. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's no evidence that Reim would have felt the other way, that the value of having a bigger shul would justify taking away the other value of having more convenient locations. So if you already have a few shuls and they're inconvenient, you know, they'll be more convenient for some people, Rav Moshe says that you shouldn't take that away, leaving aside the conservative reform issue, you shouldn't take that away in order to get to the value of Rovam Hadras Melech. So that's very much the Feinstein thinks, that it's completely prohibited, it's wrong to combine these shuls and to sell three of them, this. Now, he doesn't get into it, but it seems to me from the way his discussion goes that it'd be clear that some of this depends on whether it's true that all four shuls are fully functioning and well-functioning, and if some of the shuls are closing down because they can't keep going, that'll be a whole different discussion. And then the reform and conservative question would still come up, but a lot of this depends on facts on the grounds. It's a reminder that you have lots of values here, of real halakhic values here. The value of Rav Hadras Melech, the idea that we like to have as many people davening together as we can, the value of making shuls convenient for people, having shuls convenient for people so the more people will be able to go, the value of not stopping people from doing a mitzvah if they want to do a mitzvah, all those values have to be put together, and in each case, the answer, the conclusion might be different, but those are the questions that come up for us as we think about these questions. So those are some tshuvot for Moshe Feinstein. We missed one, I ran out of time, but those are some tshuvot for Moshe Feinstein on the 19th of Tevet, most of them from 1972, 1978, 1972. Have a great day.